Tonight's reading is from Romans chapter 1 and verses 18 to 23. It's on page 1128. Romans chapter 1, starting at verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
And if you were here last Sunday evening, we were introduced to these words, the ones which immediately precede the reading we had this evening. Some classic words of the Apostle Paul, where he says, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it's the power of God for salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew and then the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith." Well, a question arises from that is, from what is it that I need to be saved from? And we read in the passage that we've got this evening, the answer, verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven. Now, that doesn't sound too good, does it? In fact, it sounds rather nasty. So what exactly is the wrath of God? Well, nowadays, if you want to find out anything, you kind of go to a search engine. I remember doing this a few years ago. And what do you find? Well, I got this little Japanese website. I checked today, and it's no longer in existence. But it was called nogod.com. And there you'll find a neat little computer game to play. I can see someone on a laptop. Or an iPad. I bet he's trying to check. Well, you won't find it, Graham. It's a very idyllic pastoral setting. There's cattle, there's sheep, there are human beings all going about their daily lives. And then there is a cloud with a streak of lightning emerging from it. The game is all set. And you get to play God, chucking out forks of lightning, zapping everyone down below out of existence. And yeah, I did succumb to playing that game. You know, I played God for a while. And I'm sure that many people, when they hear the expression, the wrath of God, that this is the kind of image that comes into their head, the image of some capricious old deity waking up in a bad mood, reads the overnight reports from the angels about life on earth, gets pretty hacked off with what he hears, and so chucks out a few forks of lightning, somehow zapping a few thousand people out of existence, makes him feel better, and then he's able to get on with his breakfast. Well, popular as that may be, it's not at all what the Bible means when it refers to the wrath of God. Some people, like that website, imagine that God's anger is a reflection of the worst excesses of human anger. In other words, irrational, uncontrollable, capricious. Just like Ralph Fiennes, if you can remember the black and white film, Schindler's List, where Ralph Fiennes is the commandant of the concentration camp. And he has a balcony over which he surveys the whole camp. And with his sniper rifle, from time to time, he was going to strut the balcony. And he'd go, pop, just like that. And that's how that's another human example of somebody just being incredibly capricious, irrational, uncontrollable, just bumping people off as he feels fit. It's not difficult to see where people get this kind of notion from, because it is true that in biblical history, God has at times acted directly in judgment. All those occasions were occasions to warn people, saying, in effect, you know, you're fortunate, you've escaped. But this is just a foretaste of a judgment to come at the end of time. Some of the classic examples where God has intervened directly were the flood, was Sodom and Gomorrah and the deluge there, the 10 plagues of Egypt, the conquest of Canaan, the eradication of 185,000 Assyrians as they besieged Jerusalem in 701 BC. They're just a few of the highlights where God acted directly, publicly, visibly. They were designed as a warning to others then and now as we read them, that he will intervene in judgment on everyone one day in the future. Now, all those groups that he acted upon in the past were people who were guilty. He'd previously exercised immense amount of mercy towards them and the pretty appalling things which they got up to, such as child sacrifice and other things. But in working out his plan of salvation, the time would come to punish them. And in doing so, he was completely free of any kind of venom or malice. He was just acting justly. He wasn't throwing some kind of wobbler. He wasn't being spiteful. He wasn't being vengeful. He was acting justly. And we, in our best moments, we do demand of a deity, if a deity exists, we would expect him to act justly, wouldn't we? I mean, we would not expect the murderer of somebody to actually get away with things scot-free, would we? Another way in which God does act in judgment now, as well as then, is where it's just, in effect, an impersonal cause and effect. If we shut God out, if we therefore kind of do our own thing, we shouldn't be surprised if things adverse happen to us, and that's what we do find in life. If you take, for example, promiscuity, that can result in some pretty nasty, if not fatal, diseases. But the wrath of, whilst that might be an expression of God acting in judgment on us, his primary sense is when it's going to happen at the end of time. So what his wrath is his deep personal abhorrence of anything that's evil and anything that damages his creation and his creatures who he has brought into being. I picked up this very shrewd point. The alternative to wrath is not love, but neutrality in moral conflicts. And God is not neutral. On the contrary, his wrath is his holy hostility to evil, his refusal to condone it or to come to terms with it. It's his just judgment upon it. In 1972, just after I'd finished my A-levels, you can work out how old I am, there was the Olympic Games in Munich. A number of Israeli athletes were murdered by the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. The Israeli Secret Service, Mossad, drew up a list of all those they knew to have been involved. And they codenamed their operation the Wrath of God. And over the next few years, they assassinated all but one of the people who had taken part in that massacre. In other words, there was no escaping justice. There was no escaping the slaughter of the innocent athletes. And there'll be no escaping God's justice. He is not indifferent to evil. He is opposed to it, and he will deal with it at the end of time when everybody has to give an account of their life to him. And it is, as I said, what we would expect today. If you think of the murder of that 14-year-old girl, Alice Gross, at the end of August. Her body was found last week. It might seem that the suspected murderer has escaped justice in this life because it seems that He then killed himself. The police found a body yesterday. But of course, he won't escape ultimate justice. He will have to face God. Similarly, we don't expect that those people who have beheaded journalists and aid workers, they might escape justice in this life, but they won't escape it at the end of life. There is a just God, and he calls everybody to account. So, against what is God's wrath revealed? We read verse 18, against all the godlessness and wickedness of men. Godlessness means basically shutting the true God out of our lives, living without reference to him. And wickedness, literally unrighteousness, is simply not the right way of living. Godlessness, you might say, contravenes the first four of the Ten Commandments, and unrighteousness contravenes the remaining six of the Ten Commandments. But you might say, is that fair? What about people who've never heard of the Ten Commandments? Are they culpable? Are they culpable? Can you blame them if they don't know what the rules are? The great philosopher Bertrand Russell was once asked what he would say if he found himself standing before God on the judgment day, and God asked him, "Why didn't you believe in me?" Russell replied, "I would say, not enough evidence, God, not enough evidence." Now, we might be tempted to have some sympathy with that, but that is not actually the reality of the situation. Look at what Paul writes concerning human beings' knowledge of God. He describes them as those who, verse 18, suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. That's God's take. He thinks everybody knows he exists and knows something about his eternal qualities. They have them, we'll see in chapter 2 of Romans. He expects them to have a moral barometer that has a fairly good sense of right and wrong, because they've been created in his image and he is a moral God. Listen to this story and see what you deduce. There were four men wandering through the Sahara Desert, and in the distance they saw a beautiful palace, and each of the four offered an explanation as to how it came to be there. The first said that it wasn't really there at all. It was a mirage. You get mirages in the desert where everything goes a bit sort of fuzzy in the distance, and they thought they saw this beautiful palace, but it wasn't really there. The second said it had always been there. It was old as the desert itself. And the third, thinking that both those were fairly unlikely, said this is what has happened. By a remarkable process of chance, the wind and the rain have blown the grains of sand about over billions of years and fashioned them into this beautiful palace. And the fourth member of the party simply said, "Well, actually, I know the architect who built it." Now, which of those do you think the most plausible? They are four explanations as to the origins of the universe. Is the universe an illusion? That's what Eastern religions think, that it's all a figment of our imagination. It doesn't really exist. The next view, that the universe has always been there, doesn't have much traction today. The prevailing scientific view traces its origins back to an initial explosion which propelled it into existence. In other words, it had a beginning. Or was there once nothing that has become something by chance? Or do you know of anything where nothing becomes something? And the fourth one, that creation requires a creator. Even if there was a bang, somebody outside of time and space has to actually kick the whole thing into existence. I'll take a little look at this little animation. It lasts about 4 minutes. I need some lights down here. Might need to put the volume up a bit.
This is or ever is, or ever was, or ever will be. One approach to answering this question is the cosmological argument. It goes like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore, the universe has a cause. Is the first premise true? Let's consider. Believing that something can pop into existence without a cause is more of a stretch than believing in magic. At least with magic, you've got a hat and a magician. And if something can come into being from nothing, then why don't we see this happening all the time? No, everyday experience and scientific evidence confirm our first premise. If something begins to exist, it must have a cause. But what about our second premise? Did the universe begin, or has it always existed? Atheists have typically said that the universe has been here forever. The universe is just there, and that's all. First, let's consider the second law of thermodynamics. It tells us the universe is slowly running out of usable energy, and that's the point. If the universe had been here forever, it would have run out of usable energy by now. The second law points us to a universe that has a definite beginning. This is further confirmed by a series of remarkable scientific discoveries. In 1950, Albert Einstein presented his general theory of relativity. This allowed us, for the first time, to talk meaningfully about the past history of the universe. Next, Alexander Friedman and George Lemaître, each working Einstein's equations, predicted that the universe is expanding. Then in 1929, Edwin Hubble measured the redshift and light from distant galaxies. This empirical evidence confirmed not only that the universe is expanding, but that it sprang into being from a single point in the finite past. It was a monumental discovery, almost beyond comprehension. However, not everyone is fond of a finite universe, so it wasn't long before alternative models popped into existence. But one by one, these models failed to stand the test of time. More recently, three leading cosmologists, Arvind Bort, Alan Booth, and Alexander Lemaître, proved that any universe which has on average been expanding throughout its history cannot be eternal in the past, but must have an absolute beginning. This even applies to the multiverse, if there is such a thing. This means that scientists can no longer hide behind a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Any adequate model must have a beginning, just like the standard model. It's quite plausible then that both premises of the argument are true. This means that the conclusion is also true. The universe has a cause. And since the universe can't cause itself, its cause must be beyond the space-time universe. It must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, uncaused, and unimaginably powerful, much like God. The cosmological argument shows that, in fact, it is quite reasonable to believe that God does exist.
Well, I hope you found that helpful, even if some of the finer points are, for me, a challenge. That's because I don't possess any O levels in any science. But there's a thing called natural theology. Natural theology simply means that what we can know about God outside of what the Bible tells us. Sometimes that's called general revelation. In other words, it's what can be known by everybody who hasn't picked up a Bible to read it. What the Bible what we call special revelation is revelation recorded in the Bible, that where God has acted through prophets and apostles and supremely through Jesus. And in natural theology, there are a number of arguments. That one is called the cosmological argument. Basically, a creation requires a creator. Another one is the teleological argument. It's also known as the argument from design. It's an argument for the existence of God, or more generally for an intelligent creator, which isn't the same as intelligent design. It's based on perceived evidence of deliberate design in the natural and physical world. And here's a second, I hope, helpful video clip that gives evidence for this fine-tuning of the universe. Again, let the kind of some of the technical details, they go through about half a dozen kind of formulas in about 20 seconds. Don't worry about the details, just get the big picture, and I think you'll find it helpful.
From galaxies and stars, down to atoms and subatomic particles, the very structure of our universe is determined by these numbers. These are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. Scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers has been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value, a value that falls within an exceedingly narrow, life-permitting range. If any one of these numbers were altered, by even a hair's breadth, no physical, interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. Consider gravity, for example. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant. If this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. To understand how exceedingly narrow this life-permitting range is, imagine a dial divided into 10 to the 60th increments. To get a handle on how many tiny points in the dial this is, compare it to the number of cells in your body, or the number of seconds that have ticked by since time began. If the gravitational constant had been out of tune by just one of these infinitesimally small increments, the universe would either have expanded and thinned out so rapidly that no stars would and life didn't exist, or it would collapse back on itself with the same result, no stars, no planets, and no life. Or consider the expansion rate of the universe. This is driven by the cosmological constant, a change in its value by a mere one part in 10 to the 120 parts would cause the universe to expand too rapidly, or too slowly. In either case, the universe would again be life prohibited. Or another example of fine-tuning. If the mass and energy of the early universe were not evenly distributed to an incomprehensible precision of 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, the universe would be hostile to life of any kind. The fact is, our universe permits physical, interactive life only because these, and many other numbers, have been independently and exquisitely balanced on a razor's edge. Wherever physicists look, they see examples of fine-tuning. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features that the universe has, he's hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. What is the best explanation for this astounding phenomenon? There are three life options. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Which of these options is the most plausible? According to this alternative, the universe must be life-permitting. The precise values of these constants and quantities could not be otherwise. But is this plausible? Is a life-prohibiting universe impossible? Far from it. It's not only possible, it's far more likely than a life-permitting universe. The constants and quantities are not determined by the laws of nature. There's no reason or evidence to suggest that fine-tuning is necessary. How about chance? Did we just get really, 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 really lucky? No. The probabilities involved are so ridiculously remote as to put the fine-tuning well beyond the reach of chance. So, in an effort to keep this option alive, some have gone beyond empirical science and opted for a more speculative approach, known as the multiverse. They imagine a universe generator that cranks out such a vast number of universes that odds are, life from many universes will eventually pop out. However, there's no scientific evidence for the existence of this multiverse. It cannot be detected, observed, measured, or proved. And the universe generator itself would require an enormous amount of fine-tuning. Furthermore, small patches of order are far more probable than big ones. So the most probable observable universe would be a small one inhabited by a single, simple observer. But what we actually observe is the very thing that we should least expect, a vast, spectacularly complex, highly ordered universe inhabited by billions of other observers. So even if the multiverse existed, which is a moot point, it wouldn't do anything to explain the fine-tuning. Given the implausibility of physical necessity or chance, the best explanation for why the universe is fine-tuned for life may very well be it was designed that way. A common sense interpretation of facts suggests that a super intellect monkeys with physics, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. There is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge.
So if you want to find those clips, they're on reasonablefaith.org website. They are quite succinct and quite helpful, and I think quite convincing. But they'll only tell you that there's a God and a little bit about him. He won't tell you all about what we know through reading the Bible. But basically, what does the Apostle Paul say about how human beings have responded to this fact that creation indicates there must be a creator behind it? And if you do know anything about how it's been created, and the incredible way in which a whole lot of variants have to come together in order for our universe to exist, then how can you not think that there is a God, somebody creating, designing it at all? You see, some of the scientists who are flagged up there, some of them are theists, some of them are Christians, and some of them are atheists. Why? What would Paul say why somebody would actually deny God's existence? Well, this is what his take is, verse 21. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. And in 18, we were told that they suppress the truth. So let's try and unpack that. What is sin in the Bible? Sin is rebellion against God. People today tend to understand sin as just the various things we do that are wrong, examples of our bad behavior. But that completely misses the personal nature of our rebellion against the Creator God. So we have to distinguish between sin singular, meaning rebellion against God, suppressing the truth of his existence, trying to convince ourselves he's not there, and sins, meaning the outward display of our rebellion. Our rejection of God results in a change in the object of our affections. These affections don't stay in a vacuum, but get redirected so that our devotion goes elsewhere to images and created things. Paul's classic description of idolatry reminds us of Israel's worship of the golden calf in Exodus 32, but applies no less, of course, to our present-day pursuit of possessions or our devotion to alternative ideologies. Ultimately, since all idolatry is a matter of our own decision, we are replacing God with ourselves. So sin is rebellion against God. We suppress it. We don't want him. We don't want to recognize him because we want to do our own thing. And he is an inconvenient interference. So it is quite willful sin. We don't fall accidentally into sin. It is a conscious thing. Though they know the right response to the Creator, verse 21, they deliberately reject him. They suppress that truth. You see, beliefs and behavior go together. If you shut God out of your life, you'll be drawn to fill it with other things. In fact, you'll be tempted away and will find you want to do things which God doesn't want you to do because he knows they will be destructive of you and of others. But if you engage in those things, you will acquire a guilty conscience. That's just the way we're wired up as human beings. And that guilty conscience can be tormenting. So what do you do about a guilty conscience? One solution is to say that there is no God and that your guilty conscience is merely you going against the cultural norms of the society in which you happen to be most familiar. So you'll suppress the truth about God in order to quieten your conscience and to allow yourself to carry on living in what God would call a sinful way of life. And sin is stupid. In the Old Testament, idolatry is always forbidden, Exodus 20, verse 4. But it's also ridiculed by the prophets. Isaiah would be one example who really kind of ridicules idolatry. And here, though, in Paul, we read, they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for the images made to look like mortal man and birds and reptiles, 23. The glory of God is the outward shining of his invisible being. Human beings are meant to shine as God-like creatures, Genesis 1:26. When we look at a human being, we are meant to be able to say, ah, now I see what God is like. The reason why we lack this glory is that by nature, we direct our affections and energies downwards towards created people, projects and principles, all of which are idols, rather than upward towards our Creator. The result is that we can no longer think straight. Their thinking became futile. Claiming to be wise, they became as fools. Or desire or choose right, their foolish hearts were darkened. We can express this in this diagram, hopefully. Ah, there we go, good. So, on the left, we as human beings are meant to worship our Creator, to orientate our life around him. And we are responsible under him to be stewards, managers of his created order, his world. We're here to make the very best use of our lives in the service of God. But what has happened is that human beings have frozen out the Creator, rejected him, and instead worship the created order. They worship the things that they make, or that there are, possessions. If that's what's most important, that's what we worship. God has been shut out. So, in summary, God has shown enough of himself, the Apostle Paul would argue, for us to be able to know that he is for real. And we are meant then to take the opportunity to get our relationship with him right. But we've chosen quite deliberately not to recognize the truth. As a consequence, we shouldn't be surprised if things go wrong in the lives of human beings, our lives and the lives of others. That is an expression of the wrath of God working out impersonally now. It's almost automatic. Shut God out. Don't orientate around the way the Creator made us. I mean, the best way to run any piece of equipment is to follow the Maker's instructions. As soon as we think, you know, I don't need to read the instructions, get on and do it, we mess things up. Now, the gospel that Romans, the letter to Romans is all about, is about reversing the relationship that we inherit, that we're born into, the one on the right. Reverse our relationship and get it right, to get our relationship with God right and with the world in which we live in right. And that will avoid the expression of his wrath on the final day of judgment, where there will be a verdict, and unless we change our position, we shift from one to the other, that verdict will be adverse. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we're conscious that we've just looked at these few verses, and they may look bleak, but we thank you that there are the verses that went before, and there are the verses which will go afterwards, which tell us how we can be put right with you. Once we recognize that you do exist, and that we happen to have made a mess of things, we know that we have an instinctively gut knowledge that somehow or other you can enable us to be put right with you and live the way you intended. We pray that we would have our minds open to discover the full riches of that message as we look at Paul's letter in the evenings to come. Amen.